I'm Dave Heller, and this is Newswork Tonight. Pennsylvania lawmakers are supposed to pass a state budget by the end of the month. All right, you're forgiven if you doubt they'll meet that deadline. WHYY's Laura Benchoff reports that nonprofits across the state are still assessing the damage brought by the current budget coming 9 months late.
Maria Macaluso with the Women's Center of Montgomery County says her group saw the toll of the budget impasse firsthand, how it affected women fleeing domestic abuse.
You had somebody in an abusive relationship. We have relocation funds that we can help them move, get a new home, get bus fare to leave their abuser. But because we had no cash flow, we had to say no to all those people.
The Pennsylvania Association of Nonprofit Organizations recently surveyed its members to gather stories like Macaluso's. Of the 176 agencies asked, 68% said their bottom lines suffered while waiting for a state budget. Alan Edelstein with Family and Community Service of Delaware County says his group survived on its reserve cash, but it wasn't able to keep its food pantry as stocked because the state wasn't sending the food that it usually does.
You know, that hurt folks because there were fewer food commodities that were made available.
Lawmakers can do something to make sure this doesn't happen again, says Ann Gingrich, executive director of the Pennsylvania Association of Nonprofit Organizations. Pass a budget.
Pass a budget. How do we avoid this next year? Pass the budget.
If not, hers and other groups representing nonprofits are exploring ways to change Pennsylvania law so they don't get hurt again. Laura Benchoff, WHYY News.
Two Democrats are trying to unseat Republican Congressman Tom MacArthur in New Jersey's 3rd District. It covers most of Burlington County and parts of Ocean County. From the New Jersey desk, WHYY's Joe Hernandez reports.
In 2014, at an event marking the second anniversary of Hurricane Sandy, Governor Chris Christie got into it with a protester who accused him of bungling New Jersey's recovery from the storm.
You want to have the conversation later? I'm happy to have it, buddy. But until that time, sit down and shut up.
The sit down and shut up moment became infamous, and that protester, Spring Lake Tavern owner Jim Keady, is now running for Congress. He accuses Christie and 3rd District Congressman Tom MacArthur, a former insurance executive, of failing New Jerseyans affected by the storm. And he says not enough has been done to figure out why.
If we're going to investigate the failure of the recovery on Hurricane Sandy, we need to be doing it across the board, and we need an independent advocate who isn't tied to Governor Christie, who isn't tied to the big insurance companies that can really stand up and speak out for the people in New Jersey.
His opponent is Delanco resident Fred Laverne, a former mortgage broker who's now semi-retired. Laverne says he's focusing on five main issues in his campaign: jobs, Social Security, health care, veterans, and the environment.
Each one has specific goals that we have set to meet, and we have specific plans to do so. That's a big difference between myself and my opponent. He pops out pretty little bumper sticker phrases. We actually have plans for action.
Laverne is currently seeking Chapter 13 bankruptcy protection. The Burlington County Democrats are endorsing Laverne, while Keady has the backing of the Ocean County Democrats. Voters will make their decision in the state's primary election on Tuesday. From the New Jersey desk, I'm Joe Hernandez, WHYY News.
An annual fiscal health outlook by state ranks Pennsylvania and New Jersey and Delaware solidly in the second tier. Let's make sense of the numbers with study author Eileen Norcross, senior research fellow with the Mercatus Center at George Mason University and director of its state and local policy project. Eileen, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
Thanks for having me.
Let's see here. Delaware 38, Pennsylvania right behind, and New Jersey very close to the bottom, ranked number 48th. What are some of the variables that account for these ratings?
Well, we looked at the short term and the long term, and in the case of New Jersey and Pennsylvania, they don't do so well in both cases. They have low levels of cash, which means there's not enough cash on hand to cover, let's say, a recession, and they have long-term debts that have been piling up. They have large pension liabilities, unfunded pension liabilities, and they use a lot of debt finance and have large long-term liabilities.
Why don't we look at Puerto Rico as the standard for how bad things can get? Are these states in our region vulnerable to that extent?
In the sense that I think if you engage in a lot of irresponsible deficit financing over a long period of time, that certainly puts you in a bad position. But unlike Puerto Rico, these are states with much stronger economies. They have not taken on the same levels of debt that Puerto Rico has. So some of the practices, I think, need to be examined. Puerto Rico also has deeply underfunded pensions. It has had a practice of using budget gimmicks to solve short-term problems. And in some of the bottom-ranked states, we see some of those same behaviors.
So practices include accounting practices.
Accounting practices that don't tell us the full size of the liabilities in the case of pensions, and also the usage of debt to cover shortfalls, which is not a great practice.
To what extent are these rankings volatile from year to year?
In the case of the bottom states, I don't think there's a lot of volatility because these are states that have had structural issues for a long time. They've had a hard time balancing their budgets. They've had a hard time bolstering those rainy day funds, and they have ongoing pension problems. At the top of the rankings, we've got states that are highly reliant on oil revenues. And although they do well in this ranking, shortly after these reports came out, oil prices fell. And going forward, it'll be interesting to see how they fare. So the extent to which a state is reliant on volatile revenues, that could affect their short-term fiscal health.
So you're not proposing that we should all pack up and move to Alaska?
No. In fact, the numbers are a little misleading for Alaska because although they have a lot of money on paper, a lot of that is locked up in their permanent fund. And right now they're struggling with a budget deficit. So it is important to look behind some of these numbers and see whether they can access some of this cash.
Is there a correlation between aspects of personal financial well-being and this report ranking? In other words, if you can live in New Jersey, does that inordinately mean you're not going to feel secure about your own finances?
Well, I think that taxpayers are well to pay attention. These are states, I think, both in the case of New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and some of the bottom-ranked states, where they're going to have to make some difficult choices in the coming years. How are they going to fund pensions? Are there going to be budget cuts, or is this going to come out of higher taxes? These kind of trade-offs are real, so that could, in fact, affect the fiscal well-being of residents in the future.
Can we look at the states as an aggregate and make sense of where the nation's economy is going?
It's hard to say because this study does look into the particular finances of states, but I think that in general, post-recession, some states have come out of that a little more strongly than others. Their revenues are going up, and they're able to balance their budgets, whereas the states that were in a bad shape before the recession really have not gotten out of that, and that's due to that sort of long-term habit of taking on debt, not paying long-term obligations.
Who's most apt to use the numbers you generated and toward what end?
I'm hoping they're used by both policymakers and the public to really strike up a conversation on the extent to which we can get a really quick understanding of state fiscal health. The states put out these reports. No one's going to sit down and read a 200-page audited report, and I'm hoping this study makes those audits better and makes the data more accessible to the public.
Eileen Norcross is Senior Research Fellow with the Mercatus Center at George Mason University, also Director of its State and Local Policy Project. Still ahead, the Philadelphia Water Department has won accolades for its long-term plan to green the city and manage storm water.
Right now, every year, those projects are keeping about 600 million gallons of sewage water out of our streams.
There's a way for city residents to take part in the plan. We'll learn how as NewsWorks Tonight continues on WHYY. Our weeks and weeks of spring showers may be over, but Philadelphia Water is always thinking about rain. Its massive 25-year-long project called Green City Clean Waters focuses quite a lot on stormwater and how to manage it. Much of the plan involves a long to-do list of infrastructure projects for the water and streets departments, but there's a way for residents to participate. The Rain Check program helps residents pay for projects that reduce stormwater runoff from their properties. WHYY's Kimberly Haas checked out Rain Check with a project of her own.
My home is a true Philadelphia classic, a Trinity house, with a tiny footprint of 298 square feet. On the upside, I love its energy efficiency and charm of a bygone era. However, the appeal is dampened when it rains. Without a bit of open space, water pools all over the surrounding concrete. The water spilling off of the roof of my house and all the others in the neighborhood goes directly into the city's sewer system. We've all seen the results, overflowing sewer grates and flooded street corners. What's not so apparent is the effect on the region's waterways.
When it rains, treatment plant can't keep up with cleaning all of the water, so it's designed to overflow into our rivers.
Maggie Dunn is a community planner for Philadelphia Water.
So every time it rains, we end up with diluted sewage in our rivers and streams.
Since 2011, the Philadelphia Water Department has been working to lessen the effects of our concrete jungle with its Green City Clean Waters Plan.
The idea behind the plan is that if we plant more plants and trees throughout the city, that will help restore some of the natural water cycle and soak up some of that water when it rains.
The Water and Streets Departments have been outfitting whole blocks with porous pavement, carving out long tree trenches at street corners, and adding green spaces to playgrounds and schoolyards to slow the flow of rainwater. As the project approaches its five-year anniversary, Dunn says it's on track.
Right now, every year, those projects are keeping about 600 million gallons of sewage water out of our streams.
But it goes beyond streets and sidewalks that can't soak up the rainwater. Roofs, courtyards, backyard patios. Residential properties add a lot of impervious surface to the cityscape, and Philadelphia Water realized that to meet its goal, it would need to enlist residents in the effort. That's how the Rain Check program was born. Managed by the Pennsylvania Horticultural Society, it installs stormwater management tools in homes in the city. A variety of options can accommodate different circumstances in neighborhoods and housing types. Program manager Zachary Popkin explains that the two most popular tools help manage rain runoff from roofs.
First, we have the rain barrels, and the rain barrels are installed for free. Then we have the downspout planter box, a wooden planter box that it is a similar concept to a rain barrel in the sense that it manages roof runoff, where we'll connect the planter to the downspout from the home so that it's managing stormwater runoff coming off the roof.
For properties with more space, there are rain gardens, long basins with tree, shrub, and other plantings that can hold a lot of rain runoff, and two types of masonry projects, one to remove concrete and another to install paving that is water permeable. Back at my house, the Rain Check staff recommended a downspout planter. I found the opportunity to both manage stormwater runoff and add some greenery around my house especially appealing, so I signed up. Mike Wilcox, chair of the Hunting Park Community Garden, works as an installer for the Rain Check program. On a warm, sunny day last summer, he built my downspout planter and filled it with gravel, soil, and plants.
There's some holes in this PVC pipe that allow the water to pass through, and it drains downward, and the stone just helps it to keep it clear so that the water can easily pass through without being clogged with the soil.
Philadelphia Water's goal is to divert 85%, or nearly 8 billion gallons of stormwater, from the sewer system each year. So how much can one of the rain check options contribute to the effort?
The rain barrels that we install are 55 gallons.
Zachary Popkin from the Horticultural Society puts that seemingly small number in perspective with a bit of math.
It is certainly an incremental impact in the grand scheme of things, but we've installed several thousand rain barrels through the history of this program. So if you take 55 gallons, multiply it by several thousand rain barrels, plus add up all the other projects that the water department has done, and now we're talking about tens, hundreds, even millions of gallons of stormwater that we're managing every single time it rains.
And the numbers keep growing.
This past year, we've installed about 750 rain barrels. We typically do about 60 to 75 or 80 downspout planters per year. And in the past year, we've done about between rain gardens, depaving, and permeable paving projects, I'd say we're probably in the neighborhood of 40 to 50 in the past year, which is pretty good for us. It's been a strong year.
What's more, in addition to offering rain barrels for free, Philadelphia Water will cover most of the cost of the other options, like my downspout planter. Zachary Popkin notes another of Rain Check's benefits.
And this is something we say at PHS, we try to build beauty every day to beautify Philadelphia neighborhoods.
You can find more information about Philadelphia Water's Rain Check program at our website, newsworks.org. For WHYY, I'm Kimberly Haas.
A couple of weeks back, First Person Arts asked performers who'd won a previous storytelling competition earlier this year to tell a tale around the topic, Where I'm From. The audience winner was Sarah Ray, who remembered being an awkward 13-year-old growing up in western Maine in a tiny town called Canton, population less than 1,000. WHYY's arts and culture reporter Peter Crimmins spoke with Sarah about the highs and lows of a teenage crush.
So at the time of this story, and you're what, in eighth grade, I think?
Yeah.
At the time of this story, you're a newcomer to town.
Yeah. So this was like the first full year that all of us had lived there, and we had spent that entire year, you know, trying to work our way into these really close-knit, lifelong circles of friends. And the Turnbull family, you know, who figures very prominently in the story, they were like the coolest family of all.
So in the short time you've been in this town, you've developed a crush.
Oh, yeah.
A severe crush on Jason Turnbull,
yeah.
Who was a few years older than you. He was a high school junior and you were in eighth grade, so
yeah.
He was an older guy.
Yeah, you know. Him and his brother were like these incredible wrestlers and like cross-country runners, and they were the kind of guy that would run while dragging tractor tires because, you know, they were just strong and could do that and were in the middle of Maine, so why not?
So the story that you tell, it takes mm-hmm. place around Christmas.
Yeah.
And your family has been – the new family in town has been roped into singing the Christmas cantata.
Mm-hmm.
You are the church choir. You and your three siblings are the entirety of the youth choir.
Because there's literally no other youths in the church. The congregation at this point was basically my family of six and then the nursing home from the town. So that's kind of the reason that we agreed to do it, was because we knew that the only people that were going to be there were people from the nursing home.
You never expected Jason Turnbull to come into that church to hear you sing.
No, that was pretty much the worst case scenario that we could imagine. The hot, chiseled piece of man meat, high school junior, that I had spent my entire eighth grade year lusting for, and who now was walking through the church in his finest camel brown Carhartt jacket. Jesus! When it happened, both me and my older brother were just...
Because your older brother was trying to get in with the cool guy, too.
Yeah,
he wanted to be good with Jason Turnbull.
Yeah, and he was a freshman in high school at this point. So yeah, he had been, you know, working out with these guys and, like, you know, really was trying to get in with them. Ethan's, my older brother, his perspective on this is, you know, equally horrifying. He was just sitting up there in a Christmas sweater with his loser siblings, like, singing this song, too. And I think
it's
mostly
a pretty terrible song.
Oh, yeah. It was really just horrific.
It was written by the pastor's wife, who fancied herself a songwriter. And it was a song called Snowflake.
Snowflakes, plural. The piano cued. Chin. Snowflakes will come, and we'll have fun. Oh, how we'll sing, our voices will ring. You guys are being nice, Bila. I mean, that's so uncomfortable to listen to, right? For even 20 seconds. This song had 30 verses, of which that is one, right?
You survived it. It was mm-hmm. an embarrassing moment for you, mm-hmm. but you felt like you survived it okay. But then you had another encounter, which really clinched the deal.
Yeah.
You and your family are mm-hmm. passing out or driving around town giving Christmas cookies to your neighbors, your friends and neighbors. And you come up to the Turnbull house, mm-hmm. and your mother pushes you out the car door and say, you're the one who's going to deliver these cookies to the Turnbulls.
Hi, Jason. Here you go. I made these for you, the Christmas cookies, because it is that it's Christmas. So you can have them to enjoy here with your family in the Yuletide season. Nailed it, right? I turned to walk down the icy walkway, made it about two steps, and you guys see where this is going, right? I slipped. Like, not even like oopsie daisy, like cute little slip, but boom, like full on, parallel to the ground.
Well, the real clincher of this story is the very, very end of it, mm-hmm. just before you walk off stage.
Yeah.
You say, that's my story, that's where I came from, and by the way, I'm gay.
Yeah.
You just spent 5-6 minutes telling us about this crushing infatuation with a guy.
Mm-hmm.
You kind of respect your 13-year-old feelings for
yeah.
this guy, even though years later your feelings about romance in general mm-hmm. would suddenly radically change.
Oh, totally. I mean, I think the infatuation that 13-year-old girls are capable of with anything is just, you know, on a different level. And so, yeah, I mean, I absolutely knew that this guy was like the coolest, most attractive, you know, person I had ever seen in my life. We're all just sort of a product of those little micro moments.
That's Sarah Ray, the audience winner of the most recent storytelling competition by First Person Arts. She spoke with WHYY's Peter Crimmins about growing up in Canton, Maine. Finally this evening, the coach of the British soccer team, the Bristol Rovers, does not have a Twitter account. So for the past year, fans have instead been sending tweets to Philadelphia City Council President Daryl Clark, who happens to share the coach's name. The club's management appreciated the joke and planned to send Councilman Clark the team's jersey. City Council spokesperson and soccer fan Jane Rowe hopes the gift might get the councilman more interested in the sport.
Getting the council president to wear this sort of gear when he pretty much wears a suit every day, that's going to be my next challenge.
And the timing's great for Clark to become a Bristol Rovers fan. The team has just been promoted to a higher division in its league. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov and Kimberly Haas, with additional production today from Brett Rader. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.